Welcome to episode 15 of the Infectiousness. Today I want to pause. I won't have a guest today. I want to look back at the 14 shows that have come before this episode. I'd like to think about what we've heard and what we've learned and where the show will be going in the future. So far, my journey in this show has been incredible, much more than I had expected in the variety of topics that I've covered. It just seems to have evolved naturally, and I'm very pleased with the variety of topics we've been able to cover. And with the guests, I've met some really interesting people. Some of them I knew personally, like Dr. Charles Geschechter and David Raznick. Some I had read books by, like Peter Gottschy, who talked about mammography and the corruption in the pharmaceutical industry. And others like Eric Turner were recommended by guests on the show, or Harold Hildren, who was recommended by a listener. So I definitely appreciate feedback from the listeners. You can email me at david.crow, that's Crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, and send me suggestions for new topics and new guests. If you have some contact information for the guests, that makes my life a lot easier. And the more details you provide, the easier it is for me to evaluate whether it will be worthwhile and interesting to the audience to interview the guests. What seems to be happening is that every time I open a new door, that opens up a couple more. So the number of people and topics keeps growing. I don't know if I can keep this going forever, but I think I have a few years' worth of guests without too much difficulty. If you would like to become a sponsor of this show and have your name or company name associated and announced with each episode, please contact me. This will help me devote more time to the show as opposed to the other activities that keep me fed, but in the grand scheme of things, don't do as much good for humanity. A big thank you to the censors. Okay, I'm being a little bit sarcastic here, but if it wasn't for censorship of alternative views in our society, my guests would be so busy with interviews with CNN, BBC, with international media, that they wouldn't have time to talk to me. And so it's remarkable that some of my guests who have incredibly important things to say rarely get onto the mainstream media, if ever. The most recent show that I did with Harold Hillman, despite the audio problems that we had, I hope people persisted to listen to what was a remarkable interview. But, you know, he described how he would send papers to major scientific journals, and they would not even give him a detailed response. They would just say, no, we're not publishing this. That seems to be the approach to any innovative ideas in science and in some other areas of our society. If something is uncomfortable, you don't get angry, you don't write raging editorials about how dangerous it is. I mean, sometimes that happens. But the first approach is just a wall of silence. And so if they had to write back and say, well, the reason we're not going to publish Dr. Harold Hillman's ideas on electron microscopy is because, then they'd have to come up with an excuse. And it would be pretty obvious that it was a lame excuse. And so that would just open up the debate. So to avoid any debate, they just say, sorry, we're not interested, have a nice day, find somewhere else to publish this, which of course is difficult. He described the same thing with book reviews. If a book is reviewed, particularly reviewed in a positive way by major journals, whether they're major scientific journals or major mass media journals, magazines, television, newspapers, whatever, sales will be high and will go through the roof. And if nobody reviews the book, sales will be close to zero. And only people who have a real interest and who understand that just because the mainstream media, the scientific media, perhaps, just because something is shunned or occasionally receives really negative responses from the establishment, that's almost a sign that it's worth investigating. Obviously, there are some crazy ideas that are shunned by the media because they are crazy ideas, but there's a lot of really innovative new ideas that are shunned by the media, and the reason they're shunned is because the financial interests of the pharmaceutical companies or of other major corporations are not served by overturning a paradigm that is very profitable. Before I go on to discuss the previous episodes and sort of reflect on what I've learned from the discussion, because the discussions hopefully were surprising to my audience, the things that came out of them, but they were also surprising to me. I didn't know where my guests were going to go. I didn't know them that well in many cases, and so I was pleasantly surprised in most cases by what they brought to the show. But before I get there, I'd like to read some feedback. So Roger Swan from Canada wrote to me, "Dear David, I cannot thank you enough for bringing Harold Hillman back into my life. His and Sartori's book had remained in my consciousness since the day I bought it. But without our contemporary means of investigation for the masses, that would be Google, I never thought seriously as how I might scratch the itch they gave me more meaningfully. Now it's like a whole new world has opened up. How did you come across him and sufficiently to invite him to an interview? It was poignant listening to him as you could hear his age, yet also his burning desire still to engage in scientific debate, so thwarted, so marginalized. I would love for him to come here to be recognized in some small way at least. It is the indefatigable resolve of people like Dr. Harold Hillman and indeed yourself that keep me doing what I can do as a grunt, a foot soldier, slinging buckshot at radio icons and local media experts." And then Roger talks about possibly organizing a workshop in Canada to talk to some of these people, which certainly would be good somewhere in the future if we could get some of these guests to actually appear in person together. That would certainly be something that would be very worthwhile. And that's something where funding, of course, is necessary. So if anybody has ideas on how to fund a conference where these censored voices could be heard, I'm all ears. Bud Weiss, who was actually the person, the listener, who recommended Dr. Harold Hillman to answer Roger Swan's question about that, "David Crowe has provided a great service in his recent interview with Dr. Harold Hillman, which I will spread as best I can through my different networks. While the recording is a bit poor, you can still hear the dynamic quality of Dr. Hillman, who is in his late 80s, still committed to his last breath to get all this discussed in an open, decent forum, either in a science or medical journal, or publicly adequately covered debate. Despite huge amounts of work, over 140 scientific papers and 6 books published by small publishing companies, an enormous acknowledgement by those who have come to know him, many of whom are considered on the cutting edge of biological science, his papers are still refused publication by mainstream publications like Science and Nature, let alone the big medical journals, with no reason given, and major scientists refuse to even speak with him and will not even try to argue against him." I think that's a good summary of what's happened to Dr. Hillman. So now some feedback on the Jennifer Rath show. So this was the first time where I wanted to interview somebody who had views that were quite divergent than mine. And I want to try to do this more in the future. I want to give a respectful forum to people who have views that I consider at least partially to be wrong, without sandbagging them, without attacking them, without ad hominem attacks on their personality. I just want to ask them some questions. Maybe they'll be considered tough questions, but I think that's what this is all about. Jennifer Rath is an anthropologist who wrote a blog posting on vaccination, basically saying that any information you hear that's opposed to vaccination is wrong. Brent Hines wrote, "Dear David, I am fascinated by your shows and I have gained so much insight. Your show with Jennifer Rath was an amazing interview. You are so right. Science for many is like a religion. She is blinded by her self-righteousness. Thanks for the great shows. Each one has been a jewel." Curtis Hagen wrote to Hagen. Hagen. He told me how to pronounce his name, and now I can't remember. So I apologize in advance to Curtis. I'll just call him Curtis. He was our guest on Episode 8, and he also wrote about the Jennifer Rath show. "I just listened to this show and wanted to tell you that I thought you did well. I can only imagine that doing that kind of show is not nearly as fun as chatting with a like-minded guest, but rather is very difficult and taxing. So you deserve all the more credit for it. I thought you were fair and measured and really took the high road all the way through. It was just the right way to handle it. It was quite remarkable, really, that you were able to remain so calm. She, on the other hand, threw around words like ridiculous and crazy and ended up sounding like she was just a little bit unhinged. She obviously hadn't done her homework on you or your show. That's her fault, and it reinforces the suspicion that she hadn't really done due diligence in her study of vaccines. As far as the charge that it was a hit piece, most people in the truth movement would have been pleasantly surprised if they were treated so respectfully by a host who was taking the other side of the issue. Anyway, just wanted to congratulate you on a difficult task. Well done." Martin Barnes also wrote about the same show. He's an American living in France who's very interested in the AIDS issues and other issues of medicine. "Thanks for taking on that crazed pro-vaccine woman. What a challenge. It seems like the rhetoric is getting more and more shrill on the themes of vaccines and climate change, like demanding that we all accept their point of view or we will be shot or something. My interpretation is that we are actually winning, and this is their way of expressing their desperation." On the Marian Thompson show, Marian Thompson is a pioneer of returning breastfeeding to acceptability in America. Rose from South Africa wrote, "I've just listened to the podcast interview between the two of you." That would be me and Marian Thompson. "Thank you, David, for giving Marian the opportunity to share her amazing work with La Leche League and Another Look. What an amazing chapter of lifetime achievements, Marian. You've changed the outcomes of so many lives, mine included." Rose is a lactation consultant, helps women with breastfeeding in South Africa. Finally, Carol Stafford wrote about episode number 2, which was with Charles Geschechter. "Nice show with Charles Geschechter. I'm glad he's still involved. He's always been one of my favorites. I would certainly appreciate any more feedback that I get. Again, it's david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. And I appreciate feedback, even if it's negative. So if you hate one of the shows that I've done, please feel free to tell me. I will not be upset, and I may read your feedback on the show, even if I disagree with your position on the issue. I would like to now talk a little bit about some of the shows that I've done in the past. Episode number 1, I basically talked about my philosophy on science, which in summary basically is that there's a lot of science that has been artificially turned into facts when it's actually unproven hypotheses. And when a hypothesis in science proves to be profitable, the ability to question it virtually disappears. So profitable hypotheses in science include the war on cancer, which is basically surgery, radiation, chemotherapy against cancer. It's very profitable, and therefore people who question it, whether they are parents or whether they are patients who wish to choose a different alternative, or whether they are doctors who would like to use an alternative, are often savagely attacked. And if you try to write anything about this, you will again probably be ignored. And if they can't ignore you, they will attack you. Another very profitable hypothesis is the HIV equals AIDS equals death dogma. This is, for the number of patients, this is far more profitable than the cancer hypothesis. And again, is treated in much the same way. It was announced at a U.S. government press conference in 1984 by the head of Human and Health Services, Heckler, Margaret Heckler, and with Robert Gallo in present at the press conference. It later turned out that there were some enormous problems with the scientific work of Robert Gallo. John Crutzen wrote a book in the early 2000s called Science Fictions, The Dark Legacy of Robert Gallo, and yet this man's work is considered the truth about HIV and the causation of AIDS. But even if you accepted his research as true, he didn't prove that HIV caused AIDS. And if you question the truth of his research, when you consider the many government investigations into it and the information that was discovered about his research, you might consider that the research is worthless. And yet, on this worthless research, a multi-billion dollar industry has been built, and that industry will not tolerate any questioning. So it's no surprise that in episode 2 with Dr. Charles Geschechter, I talked about AIDS in Africa. I think what Dr. Geschechter brought to this was, by talking about Somalia, the country that he knows so well, listeners got to understand that this country has unique characteristics and unique challenges. Every region of Africa is different. There are complex histories. The ancient history of the region, the intrusions of colonialism, post-colonial exploitation for agriculture, mining, other economic interests of the West, war, environmental devastation, and environmental limitations, such as many parts of Africa being very arid or too wet. Societies had to adapt to these environmental limitations, and that's all being turned upside down by quote, modernization of Africa. And then with all these diverse regions with diverse problems caused by diverse environments and diverse histories, AIDS gets imposed as if the only problem in Africa was the unique promiscuity and sex drive of black males. So this racist notion that the sexuality of black men is a problem gets sanitized as the theory of AIDS, and then is used to explain everything in Africa as if the people in the West had no responsibility, as if the dictators in Africa had no responsibility, as if the history of Africa simply was irrelevant, and that all that mattered was the virus that came out of the jungles in the 1970s and devastated the West. And one suspects that if AIDS had never been a problem in the West, it would get a whole lot less attention. Consider the Ebola virus, for example. The West is very concerned because it's considered to be a deadly virus, and yet it's never left Africa. And so it comes into the newspapers once in a while when there's an outbreak. But between outbreaks, nobody really cares because it's not in the West. If there was a massive epidemic of Ebola, or whatever they call Ebola, in America or Europe, then I can guarantee that the funding would increase dramatically, and the attention to the disease would also increase dramatically. So one of the reasons that AIDS is such a popular disease to work on, whether it's working on the development of drugs, so-called prevention, or other things, is because it raises fears in the West. When people in the West are scared, they want to do something about it. When it's just a theoretical fear, like Ebola, the interest is much lower. Episode 3 with Peter Gottschy, I interviewed him because I had read his book on mammography. Now, I don't believe he's technically a statistician, but his statistical analysis of mammography is devastating. To summarize it, he basically proved that the benefits of mammography are zero, that the overall death rate in women post mammography programs will not be any lower. But the change brought by mammography is that the number of women who are subject to interventions, biopsies, extra radiation, possible removal of a breast through a false positive diagnosis, these harms are very real, and about something like a increase of one-third in the number of diagnoses of breast cancer will occur after mammography, yet the overall death rate will not decline, meaning that the programs are worthless. So all the harm that is done by false diagnoses, by diagnosis of a cancer that will not cause any problems, all of this, extra burden is for no benefit. There is no benefit to women from mammography. And Peter Gottschke also went on to discuss what he believes to be corruption of the medical industry, and that's something he discovered even just with mammography, that when he tried to get papers published that criticized mammography, some major journals would accept them, but other major journals would not. And even his institution, which is considered an icon of what's called evidence-based medicine, the Cochrane Institutes, he discovered that those had been corrupted by accepting pharmaceutical industry funding. And the groups that had funding, I think in this case from the radiology industry, were not interested in having negative papers published about mammography. This also illustrates that the information to make informed decisions is out there. That anybody who reads Peter Gottschke's work on mammography, I'm sure that anybody who doesn't have a financial conflict of interest will be convinced that there are major problems with the whole idea behind mammography. And yet, the information that is pro-mammography from institutions that generally have an economic benefit from mammography, that institution drowns out the critical information. And so it's no surprise that he wrote a more recent book talking about the corruption of the medical industry and referring to it as organized crime. What is also very interesting is that his education, his employment, his training is as a mainstream scientist. So this is not somebody who came out of the alternative health industry or somebody who was self-educated or any of the other things that are often used to criticize people who question the mainstream medical paradigms. He is a product of mainstream medical education. But because he followed the data and followed a search for the truth, basically, he came to radically divergent conclusions. Of course, Peter Gottschke is not alone. There are quite a number of critics of mammography. And this is one area where there is some debate in the mainstream about the value of mammography. It's not been a slam dunk for those who promote it. Episode 4 was quite different. It was kind of a romp with Liam Sheff. He's not a scientist, doesn't claim to be one, and he doesn't pretend to be an unbiased journalist. And to be honest, I don't think there's any such thing as an unbiased journalist. All journalists have built-in bias. It's just that some pretend that they don't, and others are a bit more honest. Talking to Liam Sheff is always a way to open your mind, to think about things differently, to think about different issues in a different way. Episode 5, I really wanted to talk to David Rasnick about aneuploidy, and one day I hope to talk about Dr. Peter Duisberg about the topic as well as the other side, the people who believe that mutations cause cancer. So to go to review what David Raznick told us, the main theory of the development of cancer is that a series of mutations causes cancer. Sometimes this is as many as 5 or 6 or 7 mutations that combine to cause a cancer. There's a lot of problems with this theory that David Raznick described in some detail. It's been known for over 100 years now that virtually every tumor has the wrong number of chromosomes. They are not only the wrong number, but the chromosomes are deformed. So this is kind of a mega change to the genetic materials. So a mutation is a change to a single bead on a chain of DNA, whereas aneuploidy is the duplication of certain chains of DNA. And of course, if those chains produce certain proteins, and if there's 3 of the same chain, the balance of proteins produced by the cell will be different. So based on the knowledge that every tumor is aneuploid, has the wrong number of chromosomes, it seems like a reasonable hypothesis that that's the trigger for cancer. And as David Raznick pointed out, chemicals that cause aneuploidy are much more likely to be carcinogenic than chemicals that cause mutations. And there are some chemicals that cause both aneuploidy and mutations, but the ones that cause only mutations are generally not carcinogenic, but the ones that cause aneuploidy generally are. And there has been some claims that there are what they call diploid cancer cells. What diploid is just the normal complement of chromosomes. And David Raznick talked about that and noted that the definition of diploid is not very clear and doesn't mean that all the tumor cells actually have the normal complement of chromosomes. They may have just a few too many, but given the relatively crude measurement of the number of chromosomes, it may be close to 2, but not exactly 2. And so the hypothesis that all tumor cells have an abnormal chromosome count is alive. This, of course, pushes up against an industry that researches the mutation theory of cancer. And this brings up another issue, that in science, when you're chasing a phantom, the ability to research is infinite, because you can chase a phantom forever and you will never catch it. And therefore, you can always claim more research funding. So if there was a possibility of solving a problem, that goes against the interests of the researchers. Now, I'm sure the researchers don't think like this, but if researchers conclusively proved that aneuploidy was the cause of cancer, there are many researchers who've made well-paid careers studying mutations who would basically lose all their grant funding. So there's a lot of resistance to these kinds of ideas. Episode 6 with filmmaker Eric Marola again stuck with the issue of cancer. Eric has made films on Dr. Brzezinski, who works out of Houston, and Ralph Moss, who used to work for the Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Center in New York City. But he was fired when he refused to go along with the suppression of positive research on Laetrol. This is all very interesting because Brzezinski and Moss, neither are exactly radicals when it comes to cancer. Brzezinski's treatment, while he uses naturally occurring proteins as opposed to artificial chemicals, which is the norm in cancer treatment, he's still working with patented chemicals. They are relatively non-toxic, another big difference from mainstream cancer industries. But he's certainly not a radical in terms of cancer treatment. I mean, he's radical by reference to the mainstream that sees only patented chemotherapy, radiation surgery as the only allowed modalities. But he is not radical by comparison with some of the other approaches to cancer, nutritional approaches, or Coley's toxin, which was to inject bacteria into somebody who had a cancerous tumor. But even so, he has been savagely attacked by the FDA for years, and only grudgingly have they allowed any kinds of tests of his technology. Even so, he has managed to cure many people. I think cure is probably the right word. He's never claimed that his proteins will help everybody. I think he's being quite honest about that. And it's nice to see that a filmmaker like Eric Marola would be so dedicated to get this story out there. The story of Ralph Moss is also interesting. He was in public relations at the Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Center, and he realized that he was in the business of promulgating lies. And so when he talked to the Japanese researcher who was studying Laetrile, he discovered that the research had been positive, even though the institution was saying there were no positive signs. He also found an interesting phenomenon in that the Japanese researcher, who was an elderly guy at that time and had spent his career in research, had no interest in going public with this information. He just didn't see that as his job. His job was to be in the lab doing research, and it was to people above him to make the decision about what to do with that research. And if their decision was they were going to bury the research, that was okay with him. It just wasn't his job. And that is one of the problems of modern science, the compartmentalism, not just in job descriptions, but also the feeling that one researcher in any area of science or medicine can rely absolutely on conclusions drawn by others. And so there's this idea that there are little building blocks, and that you can neatly build anything out of the building blocks and know exactly what the end result will be because you know exactly what the building blocks look like. Just like with Lego, if the building blocks weren't all a known shape, they wouldn't all interconnect. The problem with science is that it's never really quite so easy to know that research is absolutely reliable. And if there are some uncertainties, by the time you've built something complicated, the uncertainties may overwhelm any conclusions that you can make. In episode 7, we went on to another very controversial area of medicine, and that was the whole vaccine issues. Suzanne Humphreys and Roman Bistrianic have written a book, Dissolving Illusions, that talks about many issues with vaccines. They show vaccine statistics that show that generally diseases were on the decline well before vaccines came along, and that most diseases for which there is a vaccine had declined dramatically prior to the vaccine coming along. The book also provides the history of vaccine problems and stories of vaccine resistance, of cities that refused to go along with the vaccine programs, and how in many cases those cities had less of the problem that the vaccines were supposed to be preventing than the cities that went along with the vaccines. They also talk in the book about mandatory vaccine programs that go back centuries, really, at least one century. They talk about the ineffectiveness and the side effects of many vaccine programs. What is really interesting about Suzanne Humphreys in particular is that she's, again, a mainstream-trained nephrologist, an MD. And if you listen to the mainstream media on vaccines, they will certainly admit that there are critics of vaccine programs. But they never seem to admit that some of those critics are actually medical doctors. And I know that Suzanne Humphreys is not the only MD who questions the efficacy and safety of vaccination. I would have liked in this program to get a little bit more into some of the issues of virus existence, because I think that many people who question vaccinations accept the disease model. They accept that the virus exists, and they accept that it is pathogenic, that it causes disease. And there's very little questioning of that. And so they claim that the vaccine is not needed, that there's other treatments for the disease or other things. But their starting point is, you know, the disease exists, the virus causes the disease. Reading the book of Suzanne and Roman, I felt that there were places where they were saying that, in actual fact, it doesn't look like the virus or bacteria is causing the disease. In other cases, they were accepting it as a fact. So this is an area I'd like to explore in the future. You know, when we're talking about opposition to vaccines, how do we know that the virus that's proposed as a cause for the disease really is? I think in many cases, the evidence is much weaker than anybody would like to admit, and that includes opponents of vaccination. A lot of these ideas that I've been discussing are often dismissed as conspiracy theories. And so it was very interesting in episode 8 to talk to Curtis Hagen, or Hagen, I apologize again for messing up his name, about conspiracy theories. He quoted two very high-profile American, I guess, politicians. They're not really elected politicians, but they're very influential people, Sunstein and Cass, who talk about how governments can deal with conspiracy theories. So a conspiracy theory could be, for example, that a vaccine is not safe or not effective. Conspiracy theory could be that the 9/11 attack was not caused by the Saudi terrorists who the government says caused it. It was caused by other people. They're unexplained events. A conspiracy theory might be that HIV doesn't cause AIDS. So basically, a conspiracy theory really is an explanation for something that doesn't concord with the establishment theory for how it happened. I don't know why the word conspiracy theory has so much power, because there are many conspiracies in real life. I mean, basically, according to the law in the U.S., if two people get together and talk about doing something wrong, that's a conspiracy. It doesn't really take too much. The mainstream definition of the 9/11 hijackings and attacks on the World Trade Center was a conspiracy theory. There were a number of terrorists who, according to the mainstream theory, got together to plan an attack that was successful. So the mainstream theory is a conspiracy theory, but somehow it's not called that. And if somebody says Building 7 of the World Trade Centers imploded and it was not hit by a plane, they're called a conspiracy theorist. So anyway, these insiders, Sunstein and Cass, quoted by Curtis, said that, one, governments could ban conspiracy theories. So basically, that would mean that a government can say that discussion of vaccines is a conspiracy theory and will not be allowed. Now, I don't know how you shut people up. You can throw them in jail, fine them. Governments have a way to deal with this, but that's not the normal way to handle things in a democracy. Governments might impose some kind of tax on those who disseminate such theories. It just seems kind of outlandish. What kind of a tax would you impose on this? And is the tax imposed every time you state a theory? So if you publish a million books, would the tax be multiplied by a million? If you put your ideas on the internet and 10,000 people read your page, would the tax be multiplied by 10,000? And again, how do you decide that something is so wrong that the government has the right to counter it? And then it gets a little bit darker. Governments might themselves engage in counter speech, marshaling arguments to discredit conspiracy theories. Well, we see this a lot in HIV/AIDS, vaccines, cancer. There are lots of government websites that purport to tell you the truth about these disease models. So there's a government website that tells you that HIV is the cause of AIDS, and don't believe anybody who says differently. There are government websites who say that vaccines are safe and effective, that thimerosal, the mercury compound in some vaccines, does not cause autism, that vaccines do not cause autism, that there's no connection between vaccines and autism. Governments might formally hire credible private parties to engage in counter speech. And we're starting to get more information about this kind of thing, which is very easy in the world of social networking, where you never really know whether somebody on Facebook or Twitter or any other social network really exists, if they're a real person, or if they've been created by an entity. Obviously, organizations like the NSA, the CIA, the FBI have been involved in activities that probably involve this kind of thing, where there are third parties, not the government directly, who will attack people who put forward ideas that are not appreciated by the establishment. One case in particular that actually happened to an organization I was involved with, a psychologist named Dr. Seth Kalickman, I believe at the University of Connecticut, used a false name to communicate with people who questioned whether HIV caused AIDS. The false name was Joseph Newton, and we eventually obtained information that proved that he was using this false name, because he registered under the name Joseph Newton using the phone address and fax number of Dr. Seth Kalickman at a conference. And he was paid by the government in the United States through grants to study the psychology of so-called denialists, also might be called HIV/AIDS conspiracy theorists, if you want to use that word. So people who questioned whether HIV caused AIDS, and his job was to try to understand the psychology of these people as if it was some kind of psychiatric pathology, that if they only understood it better, they could understand why people are saying crazy things. They would never ask themselves, well, maybe people are saying that HIV doesn't cause AIDS because they're looking at the scientific evidence. So it's really important to look at how institutions deal with contrary theories. And I'll talk a little bit more about this when we get to Jennifer Rath and vaccination. Episode 9 of The Infectious Myth was with Rodney Richards talking about HIV testing. And this is really a complicated area in some ways. In other ways, it's very simple. The words HIV and HIV test are very powerful. The word AIDS is very powerful. And yet, when you actually try to get behind those and say, well, when we say that somebody has HIV, what does that mean? It turns out that what it means is that they've had an HIV test. So that's relatively simple. But what's an HIV test? Well, it turns out to be a complicated algorithm of two or more tests which can be reactive or non-reactive, or sometimes have values in between. And then there's an algorithm that artificially always comes out with basically this person is infected or not infected. They often avoid the use of the word infected. They will talk about positive and negative. The implication being that if you're HIV positive, you're HIV infected, but they will often avoid saying that. And so there have been some interesting court cases, Rodney Richards has been involved in these, where the issue of is this person HIV infected came to the fore. Because in the cases of criminalization of HIV, a person who is HIV infected may be barred from having sex with somebody who is HIV uninfected, without the use of a condom or without permission from the negative partner, the uninfected partner, to engage in sex, knowing that their sexual partner is HIV infected. The question is that we can't really define HIV infection, and these tests don't really define HIV infection. So the simplicity of using these words allows what may be a false paradigm to be imposed on the world. He had a positive HIV test. You hear that, and what it's supposed to do is to tell you that the person's HIV infected, even though the person who said positive HIV test did not actually say that. Everybody knows positive HIV test means infection with HIV. And so by using these powerful words, you can get some very powerful things to happen. You can send somebody to jail for the rest of their life. You can take a woman's child away from her if she refuses to give toxic drugs to her baby. So HIV testing is a very important area, not just for HIV and AIDS, but it's important to understand the model and how very complicated phenomena are reduced to very simple words that are used to manipulate people. In episode 10 of The Infectious Myth, we went to a completely different topic, which was climate change. And again, here we have a PhD scientist who spent his career at Environment Canada, specifically in the area of climate, who doesn't believe that anthropogenic or human-caused climate change is a big problem. He seemed to me like a pretty reasonable guy, extremely knowledgeable, and with a lot of facts at his fingertips on weather in Canada and India, born in India and lived most of his life in Canada. He understood the power of weather. Weather can be devastating, especially in developing countries like India. A year with too much rain, too little rain, with powerful storms, can be either very destructive or can create a bumper harvest. So the weather is certainly very important, and the climate is changing, but the question is it changing in the random way that it always changed in the past, or is it, in this case, directed towards a warming climate? So it's very interesting to talk to Madhav Kandikar, and I hope in the future to talk to somebody who does believe that anthropogenic climate change is occurring. Episode 11 was the famous discussion with Jennifer Rath. This was interesting to me because her blog post went viral very quickly. It basically, the title was something like, "Dear Parents, You Are Being Lied To." Said that any negative information about vaccines is wrong. Jennifer, who's an anthropologist who apparently doesn't have any thing to do with vaccine research in her scientific work, has a belief that's quite common in that the science itself is divorced from the knowledge base. So if you understand science, you know, you might have learned your science in biology, but that means that you understand science in physics or chemistry or some other area or psychology. And so therefore, if you're an anthropologist, you should be able to use your scientific skills to understand vaccines. And certainly to some extent that's true. If what you mean by science is critical thinking skills, that can be applied to new areas. That's how people learn things. They look at the research in new areas. But when I read Jennifer Rath's blog post, I found that the first reference she had was to Forbes magazine, the second one was the Weather Channel. There were a bunch of references to the CDC and the World Health Organization. There were also some references to scientific papers, but some of those references were inaccessible because she'd obviously accessed the papers behind a firewall of an institution that had a subscription to those journals, and then that somebody on the web would not be able to access them. And I found it very interesting that nobody had complained about the fact that these scientific papers, in many cases, were inaccessible. which said to me that when people read a paper that reinforces their viewpoint that people who oppose vaccinations are crazy, they're not interested in looking at the data. They're just interested in reinforcing their preconceived viewpoint. If people had said, well, you know, this is very interesting, but I should really check this out, and had started clicking on links, they would have complained about the fact that some of the links were broken. So what Jennifer Rath appeared to believe was that she could take a reference on, say, measles from, I believe that was the one from Forbes magazine, and that was all she needed to do. If she found an article that said that everybody should get vaccinated for measles or polio or anything else, that was good enough. And she didn't need to do any more. And I don't think that's true at all. When I put in front of her some papers about significant epidemics of measles being associated with largely or entirely vaccinated populations, she didn't seem to know how to deal with this. My thoughts were that if she had taken the scientific approach to vaccines, which is that you investigate the data that goes against your beliefs first, so that somebody who wants to write a paper saying you should get vaccinated, they first should look at all the evidence that's counter to their theory. That's the way science is supposed to work. Obviously not with Jennifer Rath. In episode 12, I talked to Marian Thompson, who I consider a modern hero, a woman along with several others who brought breastfeeding back from near extinction in the United States. And now breastfeeding since then, breastfeeding has climbed back up to probably the most popular way to feed a baby. It's the natural way. It's the right way. But she also tackled the whole issue of HIV and AIDS because in the 1990s, people were told that if you were HIV positive, you were not supposed to breastfeed your babies. She also tackled the issue of natural birth, that is, birth without a C-section, without anesthetics, she herself had births at home. So she was really a rebel in a very, if I can use the term, in a very womanly way. She was a feminist, but a counter-feminist. She was saying that women should learn more about their own bodies, about the process of producing a baby, the process of nurturing a baby, and that they should do what's best for their infants, and they should not always believe what the establishment is telling them. In episode 13, Eric Turner discussed how drug companies, researchers, and journals conspire to get ineffective drugs approved. One of these methods is through publication bias, which is that data that is positive for a new drug tends to get published in preference to data that is neutral or negative. And so when somebody comes along to do a meta-analysis, they find, surprise, surprise, that the majority of published data is positive. They publish a meta-analysis saying that this drug is effective when it actually might not be. Again, Eric Turner is one of these people who is completely a mainstream researcher, but has reached conclusions that go against the interests of the big pharmaceutical companies. And he personally decided to stop taking money from pharmaceutical companies so that he could do unbiased research. And that brings us to the Harold Hillman episode number 14, which I'm sure you all listened to. I would certainly like to apologize for the audio problems. We continue to try to work on the audio problems. Also, episode 13, I understand, is not available online because the recording did not turn out. So we will be discussing ways to deal with that as well. In the future, I have a long list of things that I would like to talk about. I have not yet talked about mental illness, but I would like to talk about pharmaceutical solutions to mental illness. And one of the things I'm interested in is psychotic outbursts, that is, school shootings, things like that, many of which appear to be associated with prescriptions of pharmaceutical drugs. So the question is, are these caused by the drugs themselves? Are they caused by people needing the drugs who don't take them, who stop taking them? Are they caused by withdrawal symptoms from drugs worsening the side effects of the drugs? I think there's a lot that needs to be talked about here. And generally, again, the mainstream media might say that so-and-so was suffering from depression or had been treated for mental illness or something like that, but they do not like to give very many details about exactly what was the treatment, what was the status of taking the drugs, and what side effects had already been reported to the psychiatrist or other health professionals. Vaccines, we need to keep talking about this. I hope to do other episodes talking about other aspects of vaccines. Fluoridation is something I have not talked about, but I would like to. Ditto for GMO, genetically modified organisms. It's a very current topic, and there's a lot to talk about, and maybe I can get both sides of this argument as well. Global warming, I mentioned I would like to have a pro-global warming advocate on the show, and I have a couple of names in mind. Another counter-medical argument is the whole issue of cholesterol and fats in heart disease. There are people who question our obsession with cholesterol and fat and our lack of care about the impact of carbohydrates, sugar in particular, on heart disease. We've talked about cancer, but I would certainly like to talk more about cancer treatment paradigms. Evidence-based medicine is what Dr. Gottschy was trying to do at the Cochrane Institute, but there are some major problems with this, with what was touted in the 1990s as a solution to all the problems with medicine. It appears that evidence-based medicine has been corrupted like many other medical models and paradigms. We haven't talked a lot about journalism, but I have talked about journalistic censorship. That's a topic that keeps coming up. Harold Hillman, the most recent episode, his work has been severely impeded by journalistic censorship at the scientific level, let alone at the level of the mass media. If the scientific media doesn't touch it, the mass media is not going to touch it. I would like to talk about scientific fraud and peer review. This is a huge problem. It's generally assumed that peer review catches scientific fraud. That's absolutely false, and I hope to get some people who can talk about these issues. There is the topic of politics. I don't want to turn this into a political podcast, but sometimes the same kinds of methods of manipulating people, the same kind of imposing a false paradigm occur with politics, as well as with science. There's a term, state crimes against democracy, which is very interesting, where the state does something in order to manipulate democracy. One of these kinds of things is called a false flag operation. And it would be interesting to talk about the evidence for whether the establishment explanation for a particular episode is true, or whether there are some other episodes, some other possible forces that caused the episode. I was just reading, for example, about the kidnapping of the Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro, supposedly by communists in the Red Brigades, but in actual fact, because he was the first centrist politician to want to talk to the communists, the benefit to killing him came from the other side. And the person who killed him had rather a shadowy background. So we still don't really know after decades whether the Italian Prime Minister was actually killed by the left or by the right. And I find these mysteries fascinating. And I hope that you will find this whole thing fascinating as well. And I hope to talk about more of these more of these topics in the future. I appreciate all feedback from my listeners. Email me at david.crow, crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. And I look forward to you joining me for future shows. Goodbye.